Hello, I'm here during the lunch rush with Janice, who owns her own food truck.
Best cheesesteaks in town.
Janice traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for her food truck business. We're here where she needs us most.
They sure are.
We make it so easy for her to save, with customised coverage that grows with her business. Sorry, I just get so emotional talking about saving folks money.
Not this onion I'm chopping?
It's just so beautiful. Oh, yeah, nice, the onion.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
With TikTok ads, our revenue went up $10 million year over year during back-to-school season. Penn Foster is online education. TikTok is great because the reach is incredible for finding a lot of different types of audiences on the platform. Creator content at scale allowed us to easily develop and distribute creator-led ads. Our return on ad spend for TikTok is 21% higher than the next best channel.
Start growing your business today. Head over to getstarted.tiktok.com/TikTokAds.
Welcome to Playful Beginnings, a podcast about the magic of play therapy for therapists, students, and anyone interested. In our podcast, we'll explore the deeper understanding of play therapy and the skills we use in working with children.
We hope to help you understand the why behind what we do and how it helps kids heal and grow. I'm Dr. Christy Opiola, a working play therapist and university professor in North Carolina.
I'm Dr. Maggie Parker, a play therapist and professor in DC.
Well, hi, Christy.
Hi, Maggie. How are you this morning?
Oh, you know, peachy keen. How are you?
It's the week before our spring break, so I'm just where we're supposed to be the week before spring break, ready for a break.
Yeah. So, well, first, actually, I want to see, because North Carolina APT just
did. We are doing something in a week.
Okay, what are you doing?
We have a conference coming up where the first full weekend in March.
Mm-hmm.
And we are bringing in Stephen Parks, who's okay. Amazing. I haven't heard of him, but it's a 2-day conference in Raleigh, North Carolina. You can still register if people want to. And the topic is liberatory and culturally responsive play therapy on the first day. And then the second day is working with children who have experienced natural disasters. We've talked about on here that North Carolina had a really big natural disaster, actually, the weekend before our fall conference that we ended up postponing. Stephen was able to change the topic to really kind of be really poignant for clinicians across our state.
I wish I could come, but the VAPT conference is the same weekend. I did actually just read a cool book that kind of leads into what we were kind of wanting to talk about, but called Healing the Soul Wound. Have you read it?
I haven't finished it yet, but
yeah, same. It's just really interesting. We had Dr. Courtney Glickman come and talk to one of my classes about nature-based therapy and how further away from nature we get, that it's very difficult. And for Indigenous peoples, kind of like this intergenerational trauma that has occurred in our country and across the world with Indigenous cultures, and how that's a soul wound. And I thought that was a really thoughtful and introspective way to talk about trauma, because it's a significant trauma. And that's what we were thinking about talking about today. It's where US research is really focused at the moment, because we have this stupid article that we need to get out.
But it's so interesting. So I actually teach a trauma counseling class here at the university. And one of the books I have them read is My Grandmother's Hands. And I don't know if you've read that one.
I haven't.
But it really talks about how we all, like, our history is rooted in trauma in the U.S. No matter, you know, like the people who immigrated here in the very early years were leaving places because they were ostracized, imprisoned, whatever it was, right? So like our foundation of who we are, according to the author of this book, right, is really rooted in trauma. And if we don't start to explore just how that has been passed down generation to generation and how we've learned to manage and cope with that, right? We don't ever really get to see how then we relate to other people who are also either currently or historically have experienced trauma. But it's a really great book. It really focuses in on like somatic work related to trauma.
I'll need to check it out.
But it's a great book. It's very popular with my students. I often hear that it's the favorite this is their favorite textbook they've read in the whole program. And I'm like, wow, okay.
So, my grandmother's hands. Look, I'm going to write myself right now.
Yeah, by Rezma Menakin. So it's a great book. He has done some amazing work, really trying to not only help individual clients, but he's also worked with large systems to try to get systems more informed and responsive to trauma. So it's not one you can read quickly, though.
Yeah.
With activities and other stuff. And I really encourage if people read this book to kind of sit in the somatic work that he's talking about, because it does bring up a lot and really helps you kind of have a lot of empathy.
Yeah. Well, I think that's kind of the crux of what you and I think when we, because we present on trauma a lot and trauma and child-centered play therapy. And I think sometimes it's like, I think as a concept, people mm-hmm. are really empathic. Like, this is terrible that this has happened, right? But on an individual level, I think for caretakers and adults and children that are around other children who have experienced trauma, it can be really difficult. And so trying to remember, like, to have that empathy, and it can be hard. And sometimes we have to remind ourselves, because sometimes it presents as like pushing people away, often presents as pushing people away or those externalizing behaviors. And it's a protective response, but it can be difficult.
Yeah.
And that was one of the cool, I think, results from the meta-analyses, was that we found that there was a significant contribution to parental or caregiver and teacher empathy, which speaks volumes, I think, that, you know, it may not be like, it may be a while until like perhaps child behavior changes, but having the caregivers around them have more empathy allows them to respond more obviously empathically and kind of continue the work that the play therapist is doing within the space, which I think will then, which I'm hypothesize is going to help a lot with kids who have experiences, but we haven't done that longitudinal part yet.
Such an important component that we keep talking about, but it is so hard, longitudinal.
Yeah. So for our listeners, when we talk about longitudinal, we have research where people do child-centered. You know, we have all this research that shows that when you do research, you have to have like a set number of sessions before you start the research so that you can make sure that, you know, it's organized and you can say, this is what we did, and it has to be very like rigid almost in order to be considered a randomized controlled trial, which is what people really look at. And that's really important. But after that, it's really helpful if you can see how kids and families are doing and teachers, you know, 3 months, 6 months, 1 year, 10 years after the intervention. And it's just really hard to do because kids move and then you get busy and there's life happens. And so there hasn't been a lot of longitudinal of like looking at what are the effects over time. So that's what we're talking about.
My dissertation study, I tried to do that and I send out emails, I send out packets, and I think one person responded of the 60 that I studied. So it is, you really have to be on top of it, maintain a really strong relationship with the clientele that you worked with to get kind of the results. I had also moved states, so it's not like I could easily link in other ways or hold something that would help facilitate it, because that would require traveling on multiple parts and that wasn't going to happen. So, but
yeah,
I want to talk about trauma today and how child-centered can be helpful for clients who've experienced trauma from like a really theoretical level. And we also wanted to share a little bit about our experiences with clients who may come to us because of their trauma histories. Mm-hmm. And so
I think you and I, we rely pretty heavily too on the work of Balin and Hughes and Vanderkolk and Perry and their neurobiological perspectives of trauma with young kids and how it impacts their brain, and then how play therapy really and child-centered play therapy can be impactful on those neurobiological systems. But I think like theoretically, there's also a whole wealth of information that aligns as well. And so I think there's a couple different ways in which you and I both conceptualize it and talk about it. But I'm interested in what is it that you see to be really beneficial of child-centered play when working with kids with trauma? That's a big question.
It is a big question. For me, I think it's the safety of the relationship and really the trust in the child to take the session at the pacing that they need to take it at. So, I don't have to facilitate stress inoculation. I don't have to facilitate any of that because I find children do it themselves independently in the playroom. And so for me, it's really internally led for the child. And I think that's where the most healing comes from. It's not so much externally someone telling them how to cope or manage it, right? They get to experience that in the safety of a relationship. And so that's what, for me, makes child-centered such a great approach to working with trauma. Is sometimes it is slower because we aren't approaching it. But I also don't find kids like shut down or refuse to do things or other stuff for the most part, right? Like within child center, I have a few kids who will request breaks along the way. Like I, this is getting really, like too heavy for me. And I want to take a little break from therapy, but that's more for really complex trauma. I wouldn't say that is an acute trauma experience or an isolated trauma experience. Those are my kids who are coming in with like really complex, typically relationally based traumas where they need to come up for air and not feel like they have to work on this really hard part of themselves. Mm-hmm. But yeah, for me, it's the relationship and the child pacing the sessions that really speak to my heart and really trust my trust in the child to take us where we need to go during session and how often they need to process the narrative and how often they need to process the experience or how they're metaphorically showing it in the playroom, however that is. That's what really speaks to me.
Yeah. I think that that's one of the things that I find really important is that often when children experience trauma, it happens to them like against their will. There's no autonomy there. They don't get to choose that this is happening. And so I want to provide them as much autonomy as possible within the play therapy space. They don't get a lot of, children inherently don't get a lot of autonomy, right? They have to do the things that they're told to do when they're told to do them, whether it's in school or at home, and like, I know I'm a play therapist. I'm also a parent. So like brushing your teeth isn't a choice. So like there are certain things that you just don't have autonomy over, but in the play space, they get to decide. And I think that's so important to allow them that space that's theirs. Mm-hmm. And I really do trust that what they need to do or what they need to process will come out. And I've seen it come out. And sometimes I don't understand how it's coming out. Right. Like sometimes it's kind of confusing, but just being able to give them that autonomy. And again, like you're saying, that trust, like I trust you, because so often kids who are presenting with trauma aren't trusted by the adults around them, or they're treated differently, whether it's because their adults are nervous about them, or they, I think sometimes like pity them or really sympathetic, which is comes from a good place, kind of like kid gloves, or that because their trauma is manifesting in symptoms of aggression or anger, which is the most common, that you don't trust them because you don't trust them to stay calm or to keep their hands where they are or to, do the things they're quote unquote supposed to do. And so having this space where you're like, I trust you, I think can be really impactful. One of the things that is I know that I cited Balin and Hughes from 2016, but I feel like I've written this sentence and said this sentence so many times, like in different articles or conference presentations. I think I wrote it. I don't know, but it's my favorite about how that unconditional positive regard and the trust and the care that we demonstrate to the child can surprise that trauma response within their brain, where they're expecting us to get angry or to push them away or to reprimand them in some ways. Like that's what they're expecting. And so when we don't, it surprises that neurobiological response. And they can then approach this from a place of pleasure versus pain. And I find that to be really important and a crux of kind of like what I lean on when I'm doing this work. And I think it was so wonderfully, I know we kind of, it's hard to like separate out our practice versus like the theoretical rationale, but I think this was so perfectly exemplified by the work that you did with a child who really struggled in relationship. And so spent a lot of time telling you how much you sucked on multiple different ways. I mean, it's like they were quite creative in the way in which they expressed their fear really to you.
And you can, like, displeasure and just my way of just who I am as a human being. I mean, but really, I agree with you. I do think it was more way of protecting and, you know, like having safety.
And you didn't respond like most other adults would, which is like, stop that. That's rude. Get out of here. Right. Which is then again, exactly what they're expecting and why they're doing it, because there's rejection, but they controlled it. And, yes. And so when you don't reject them and you you set limits, obviously, and you're a human and you respond and then you repair. And I think that is so important in the work that we do. And I think that's kind of like also where we lean on the neuroscientists of like how this is impacting their brain, because it's so different than what their brain has developed to allow that, or like to protect themselves and what to expect as a result.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know where I always heard kind of anticipatory arousal is the term for that.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Where like you're anticipating what's about to come. And so your body will naturally protect itself. Right. So it has strategies to do that. And so it's really giving them an unanticipated experience to help rewire. And I know Dr. Ray and I have talked about this, and we're not sure who we heard this from. We have different like memories of who it came from. But I know we've had conversations of thinking about like that rewiring of the brain is kind of like, if there's any nature people out here, here's a metaphor for you. It's like going on a hike on an unpaved trail, right? Where you're having to get through thickets and you're having to get through brush, right? And kind of carving your own path. That's really what I think child-centered offers to kids, right? Like the first few times they come, in particular, if relationships are threatening, scary, whatever it might be, right? That they have the opportunity to kind of carve that path, but it's not an easy path, right? You get nicked and scraped. And, you know, you may have leaves, you know, you may be covered and dirty and all that stuff, but that paths are really hard. And it's not a one-time path that really helps carve a hiking trail, right? It's like repetitive thousands of times that we go through this experience. And I think that's, for me, what child-centered does until there is a full-blown trail that a child can like work through and get to, so that they know that this pathway, this neural pathway in their brain is safe. It no longer is creating a sense of fear, but the rewiring is hard work to do and needs predictable, repetitive experiences that are mostly positive in nature, right? Yeah. There's times that, you know, they don't feel positive. So I don't want to say they're always positive, but are mostly positive as they walk through it.
Well, I think that's a great metaphor. And two, I smiled when you said that, because that's exactly where my brain was going, is the importance, like we create the safety within the space as much as we can so that they can go down that path by being consistent, by we are the same as much as we can in each session. The toys are in the same spot in each session, that as much as we can, the time, the date, like everything is predictable, so that unpredictable piece can be easier to enter into. And it's so important that we are there and present and attuned to their emotional experiences as they're doing that, so that they can have that emotional, but almost like support, like, I'm here, I hear you, I'm with you, I care about you as you're charting this very scary thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, Maggie, for something that you said, like some of those things are really in our control and are easy for us to forget as clinicians, right? Like setting the environment up to be really predictable is really important to me as a clinician who works primarily with kids who have trauma. I want every time they come to my space, right, in the playroom, that they know exactly where they're going to go. My experience is they come in with a plan. And so when the room is not the way they're anticipating it to be, it's really dysregulating, and they spend the majority of the time cleaning or doing something else to get it where it can be re-predictable for them. And then we give it a theme or something related that's not what's happening in the moment. What's happening in the moment is they're trying to repair the rupture of the room not being predictable. And it sounds silly, and it can be really challenging, in particular when you share space with other people, like to get everyone on the same page about the importance of things going back the way they were. I can be very anal retentive about it. Like, I have pictures so people know exactly how the playroom should be set up every single time. Mm-hmm. But I do think it lends to kids getting into that like working phase, getting into do the exploratory stuff that they're anticipating that they can do. The other thing that I think is important for us to talk about is like our predictability and our consistency. And that idea of what does that mean? Can I never take a break? Can I never? It's a lot of rupture and repair, rupture and repair. And if we can help them anticipate when changes are going to happen. So if you know you're having a vacation, if you know like something is coming up that it's not that we don't, we only communicate that with the caregiver, right? But we're being very intentional to communicate that. I'm not just popping it up at the last minute, unless it really is a last minute change. But if it's a predictable change, like I'm going on vacation,
right?
And I knew I was going on vacation for months ahead of time, right? Like I start to prepare my kids like 2 to 3 weeks out before we have two more sessions. And then Miss Christie is going to be off for a session. And then we're going to come back and have our regular sessions. And I'm now really good at getting parents to do the same. Like here is what I know the schedule for the month ahead, right? So that. And they're seeing the importance of helping their kids transition when changes are going to happen so that they're not as reactionary. They're not feeling as out of control or struggling with a lot of anxiety or whatever might be coming up for them in those moments. So
yeah,
little things that we can control and we can advocate for with our clients and their families. Or if we're working in schools, right? Like how do we help the school environment understand the importance of helping kids know when changes are going to happen, or we service a school here. And if one of the therapists is sick, we let all the teachers know. The teachers don't always tell the children, right? And then there's like repercussions to that. So we've worked really hard to help teachers understand the importance of helping the day be predictable for all kids. But in particular, there might be a subset of kids that we need to be very, very intentional on. And the reality is we are fallible as. That's like something that really stood out to me from my learnings from Dr. Landreth is that, you know, humans in their nature are fallible, and you as a counselor is equally as fallible as any other person that walks in your door. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, like repairing is a big part of what we do as clinicians, because ultimately we're going to make some type of hiccup in our relationship. Often not intentional, often unintentional. And sometimes our clients hear things differently than our intentions, right? And so those were when those opportunities for repairs are really important, but that we share, we care enough that we want to make a repair, I think is really important. And that includes with parents, that includes with clients, right? That includes with any partner that we work with. And I think that's just a really important component of that fellow journeyman in of being a child-centered play therapist, right? Because we're really honored to be in our clients' lives at really difficult times. And mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah. No, I think, and trying, I think one of the things that you and I both, I think, really care about in a lot of, we did a lot of presentations for school systems to be, how can you be trauma-informed and really hoping to help people see how these are children who are hurting, and sometimes the way in which they're expressing it is difficult. And so how can we move beyond our own experience of difficulty and frustration? And I think we've talked about this before, right? It's like, how do we move beyond our own experience to help understand the child from their perspective and their experience? And I think that's a lot of where a passion lies too, is how do we help others around these children empathize and respond empathically as opposed to react. And that's hard to do.
Well, and the adults doing the same thing.
Right. That's kind of what I mean, is like, how can we help move a system that is used to reacting into responding and trying to understand? And it's hard. I think it's especially hard for teachers when you have, you know, our classrooms are, you know, 28 kids and you've got things that you have to do in order to keep your job and your funding, you know, it's a lot. And so when you have kids that are acting out, it is easier to say, like, just go to the office or go to the principal, as opposed to like sitting down and crouching and being like, you're really overwhelmed right now. You're feeling really out of control right now. You're feeling really scared right now. Like, that's hard to do. And I'm not, so like, I wanted to be really clear. Like, I'm not trying to fault anybody. It's really tough.
And we have to remember that's not how their training lies, right? Like, our training lies in relational components. It doesn't matter what arm of play therapy you're in, right? Like, that is for the most part the root of all of our interventions. How we go about doing that looks different based on your theoretical approach. But many teachers are not taught to be relational in their training, right? They're taught, and I'm not saying this to like disparage in any way, right? It's just a different approach. So they're taught about being in control. They're taught about managing behavior.
Classroom management.
Yeah, which is what classroom management typically focuses on, is more of the behavioral management. And as counselors and as play therapists, our belief is behavior is a message. So it's their kid's best way to communicate that something's going on for them. They're having a feeling, they're having an experience, they're having a thought, right? And if they can't put it into words, then what they're doing is they're showing it to us behaviorally. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, but if we only look at behavior, we're only seeing part of the message.
Yeah.
So a lot of the work Maggie and I have done with schools is really helping them look at the relational component that they can bring in to be responsive instead of reactive to just behavior. Processing maybe what the behavior is, the child is trying to communicate through behavior instead of just looking at the behavior as the problem, or the behavior is just a symptom of the bigger issue that's going on for the kid.
And I think this is something too that I see a lot of times with caregivers, not necessarily the caregivers I'm working with, but, you know, as we try and build this space, I'm on a lot of different parenting sites, and this idea of like relational parenting or gentle parenting is often confused with permissive parenting, right? And I think there for a long time, it's like you have to punish your children and there has to be like, you're the authority. And so shifting into like, how can we understand what the behavior is sharing is really difficult, because that's not what we're told. I really think a lot, I've thought a lot about our interview with Dr. Ray, about how she kind of talked about child-centered being counterculture, and it is. And that really resonated with me. And I think it's hard as a system to kind of think about like, what are the behaviors really indicating? What are they telling us? What are they showing us? What is the child trying to help us understand about them? And I think that's so important. And I think you and I have both tried like individually with the work that we do, and then systematically in the presentations that we're doing. And I think now we're trying to really kind of get it out, even through this podcast, of like, why is this important? How can we understand it?
Yeah, I mean, we've shared this multiple times that children are often misunderstood, and not intentionally. They're just, we don't do a good job of helping people understand that kids are doing their best to communicate with us. The child-centered side of it, I think Dr. Ray has probably some of our more recent publications around trauma-based work with child-centered. She was able to do a large study, multi-site, multiple schools looking at trauma, which I think has informed both of us and solidified some things that we were already thinking. She just was able to put it into words for us. But kind of going back to that idea that relational interventions really help when we're looking at things like self-regulation and social skills, and that really focusing on one's ability to like internally get themselves under control, not externally being mandated.
Yelling more never caused someone to yell less.
Right. But it also sends a different message. So if I can only get myself under control when someone else is identifying that I need to get myself under control, when do I ever know to get myself under control? Right. Like if I never have to practice that skill, I can just be relying on external forces to tell me, okay, my behavior's gone too far. Oh, I've done too much. Oh, this is what they mean by too strong. I don't really know what that means, but you're saying this is too strong, so I shouldn't do this behavior, instead of them like internally being able to be aware of
their body in space, how strong, how weak, approaching things. And so I do really love that about child-centered, is it's really cueing them in to have more self-awareness of what's happening internally, maybe what their intentions and desires are and how they can get that met in a really pro-social way within our community, which would be more a socially acceptable way.
Well, and I think it also speaks kind of to bring it back to the neurobiological, right? Is that a lot of times when you're in those experiences, you're in the lower parts of your brain. You can't start thinking through what's happening. You're just in the moment. And so by asking, like, use your words, talk to me, say, you know, stop this. That's not, you're talking to, you'd be better off talking to your golden retriever. Like, it's not happening that way. And I think I try and relate that to adults is like, whenever you're really upset, does it help when someone says, calm down? Like, not usually. Usually that's going to amp me up a lot more. Like, you can watch me calm down. But we often do that with kids because we're trying to control it. And really what needs to happen is that's when we really have to get calm, because you can't regulate yourself if you're not in a safe space to regulate, right? You're going to have to continue to protect yourself if the adults around you or the people around you are responding by yelling or dismissal or rejection, right? And so it's up to us in those moments, I think in all relationships, to really kind of calm ourselves, which is really hard to do. I'm not saying that this is an easy task in life, and it's hard in the playroom. Yeah. I'm really trying to calm ourselves down and respond and slow our responses. And even when our voice kind of gets lower and we slow our speech, our rate of speech, in our breathing, that they've shown that that actually has a different response within their brain, and that they're able to hear it in a way that if we continued in the same way or we elevated, that would not happen. And I just think it's so fascinating how these are all interrelated.
Yeah. And I just want to pick up on something you said, Maggie. You had said something like, you know, they're in the lower part of their brain. So I feel like the brain stuff is so commonly talked about now, but I just want to make sure our listeners know what you're saying about that. So Our brains develop from the most primitive part of our brain, which is the low, like around the brain stem, and over time develops and expands, right? With experiences,
relationships,
you know, just being in the world when they have an environment that facilitates like the ability to fully grow and develop to the brain's best capacity. Why I'm bringing this up is because reasoning and thought is actually one of the last areas to fully develop in the brain. And so when Maggie's saying, you know, they can't actually maybe give you a verbal response because you're asking them to reason and think, it's because the brain is built for safety of our organism as a whole, right? So when information comes in, it's coming in from the lowest part, and it's going to go through each of the parts of like base survival, right? All of these different things. And there are triggers in each of those areas. So if I feel threatened in one of the lower areas of my brain, right, for my safety of my body, my brain is going to stop moving to higher order ability. It's going to stay there to protect myself as an organism. Sometimes what happens is we want kids to be able to think through, process through. We want adults to do this too, right? Yeah. And adults who have experienced trauma, this can be challenging for them as well. Because in the moment, that's not where they are, right? Their body is thinking like, I'm under attack. And each of those lower parts of the brain, and as we move up, respond in different time frames. So like the lowest part of the brain is thinking like nanoseconds, right? Like the higher order can think, you know, like, oh, in an hour or two. That the lower brain can't think that. They're thinking like, within this hot second, I need to be able to respond for safety. And so that's kind of what's happening in kids' behaviors or their responses in the moment, is as messages come through the body and they're experiencing different things, really what it's responding from is a sense of protection of the organism. So it's going to do things based on where they're getting triggered, kind of what type of support they need in those moments to manage the stress load, to manage the relationship, to manage the experience that they're having, all of those things. And so it is really fascinating. And I know that's like a really simplistic way of explaining it, but
I mean, we're not neuroscientists either.
I'm not a neuroscientist, so I can't go into all. If you want to hear those, Dr. Perry is an amazing person to listen to like hear those. There's other people out there who are really trying to break down
the neurobiology into more manageable parts for us to for us lay people to understand. And so, but yeah, but that's what's happening. So that's why Maggie's saying they can't access thinking and reasoning, is because really they're working out of protection and survival, and it's a lower brain activity in those moments. Yeah, but it also explains sometimes why we have breaks in relationships with kids, or maybe we're reactive in a moment, right? Like sometimes we get triggered.
Yeah.
Well, it's as cool as a cucumber, or be the thermostat in the room instead of a thermometer. But we're also human, right? So things get, we respond to what we're experiencing in the environment too.
Yeah, we also are human despite all of our training. And it's just a human response. And so I hope that people can hear that and recognize. Check us out on socials, and we'll keep the episodes coming because it's just a joy to be able to talk with you.
I love it.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Bye, Christy.